North Korean troops are in Russia.
If these North Korean soldiers decide to join the fight against Ukraine, they will become legitimate military targets.
Israeli bombardment of Lebanon continues.
In Lebanon, Israel's military said it had killed 3 Hezbollah commanders and some 70 fighters in the south in the past 48 hours. A day after confirming it had killed Hashem Safi al-Din, the militant group's heir apparent leader.
And what selling political merchandise can tell us about getting along.
Just because I'm Republican and she's Democrat, there's no reason that we can't coexist here in the same location. We have different feelings, different opinions about things. Certainly people wear their emotions on their sleeves, but we don't need to have hate.
Today is Thursday, October 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The United States says there is evidence of North Korean troops in Russia, a day after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Kyiv had learned that 2 North Korean military units were training in Russia for potential combat in Ukraine. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has our story.
U.S. officials say it's unclear if, when, or how the North Korean troops in Russia could deploy in the fight against Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
What exactly they're doing, left to be seen.
The impact of the few thousand North Korean troops would likely be small on the battlefield, but the political implications, analysts say, massive. Charles Kupchin is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
North Korea seems to be moving from a strategic partnership with Russia that is providing weapons, backstopping the Russian effort, but not participating in the Russian effort, to a partner that is actually a combatant. And that moves the relationship into something closer to an alliance.
The White House Wednesday raising concern about what it called a reckless and dangerous defense relationship.
Not only the concern for the impact on the war in Ukraine, but the impact that this could have in the Indo-Pacific, with Kim Jong-un benefiting to some degree.
National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby said Washington will reach out to Beijing to share perspectives and learn how China views the move. He also issued this warning to Pyongyang.
If these North Korean soldiers decide to join the fight against Ukraine, they will become legitimate military targets.
As for Russia, Kirby said any potential deployment of North Korean troops against Ukraine would be a sign of desperation and weakness.
He has to farm out the fighting to a foreign country, I think speaks volumes about how much his military is suffering and how uncertain he believes, how untenable he believes his situation is.
The United States promised new sanctions in the coming days, targeting those outside Russia who have fueled the Russian war machine. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
As for China, a Chinese embassy spokesperson in Washington tells VOA that China's position on the Ukraine crisis is consistent and clear, and we hope that all parties will work for de-escalation. As we've heard, there's now consensus among Western governments that North Korean troops are indeed in Russia. For some context and analysis, I'm joined by Miles Yu. He is a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute.
It's significant because it points to the new phenomenon in the world, that is the gradual disappearing of so-called regional security. In other words, all security problems in the world are becoming basically a global issue. So regional security is becoming global security. It's a transcontinental, it's a transoceanic, and that's why the world is witnessing a gradual division of 2 camps. One led by China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. They want to change the existing international order. And I think, regional spots of trouble like Ukraine, the Middle East, Gaza in particular, and Taiwan Strait or South China Sea, none of that is really a regional issue because every single conflict will become an issue that will get attention from the entire international community. Everybody will jump in because this world is interconnected.
Even as we are interconnected, this still is a war on the ground in Ukraine. How will the addition of North Korean troops change things for that particular battle, do you think?
I think there's a change. It could go either way. On one hand, Russia has been heavily relied on, say, the mercenary troops, the Wagner groups, basically special operations, commando type of troops. Now, that method sort of drifted away since last summer after the Wagner interaction. So they desperately need a replacement. Now, North Korea happened to have the world's largest commando force with about 120,000 to 140,000 strong, the world's largest special operations troops. So when Vladimir Putin went to Kim Jong-un last summer, they made a deal, kind of some kind of the deal between the devils. That is, North Korea would provide Russia with a troop deployment, as we're seeing right now, and instead, North Korea would get from Russia satellite launching technologies, submarine upgrade, and particularly food and energy supplies.
Is this the endless supply of men and materiel that Putin has been looking for to keep this war going?
I don't think they initially he did look that way, because North Korea, you know, is one of the leading pariah states in the world. Anything you do with North Korea is going to have instant international repercussion. So, but now Putin is in a situation of a sort of desperate strait. So he really has very few places to turn to for help. And first of all, Putin is an internationally wanted war criminal. So he really cannot travel to many places except China, North Korea, and Kazakhstan, those few countries which he would consider safe. So I think it's probably the act of desperation and necessity, not conviction. Now, back to your earlier question about how does North Koreans' participation in the war in Ukraine change the equation? My view is that North Korea's troops, even though they were well-trained, but they were fighting a different kind of war, traditional war. Now, Ukrainians are doing something totally different. They're high-tech. They're developing more into a sort of a drone warfare. So I don't think North Korea is well-equipped to deal with that kind of adversaries. So eventually, I think Ukrainians probably will have an upper hand, because drone warfare can magnify the fighting capability of one single soldier by dozens of times if you handle the drone very sufficiently and skillfully.
So that's how it might play out on the ground in Ukraine. What about in Asia? Do you see this leading to more Russian involvement, say, in the Straits of Taiwan or the South China Sea?
I hope that's not going to be the case, because Russia has been very careful in playing the balance of power game in Asia. On one hand, they want to forge some kind of a quasi-military alliance with China. On the other hand, Russia also is developing very good relationship with all of China's adversaries in the region, such as Russia's traditional friends like India and Vietnam. So but none of these countries were necessarily friendly to China, because they have their conflict with China of their own.
Miles Yu is a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute. Mr. Yu, thanks for your analysis today.
You bet.
Hezbollah has confirmed that Hashem Safedin, a top official widely expected to be the group's next leader, was killed in an Israeli strike. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued his push for a halt to fighting between Israel and the militant groups Hamas and Hezbollah. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Israeli airstrikes pound Tyre, a historic Lebanese port city. Israel began to bomb roughly 3 hours after issuing an order online for residents to flee central areas of the UNESCO-listed city. Tens of thousands of people have fled Tyre in recent weeks. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in the Middle East on Wednesday to push for a halt in fighting between Israel and militant groups Hamas and Hezbollah. But there was no respite for Tyre, usually a bustling hub for Lebanon's south. With fishermen, tourists, and even UN peacekeepers on a break from deployments near the border, spending time there by the sea. And no let-up either for besieged northern Gaza, which Palestinians were fleeing en masse on Wednesday. Health authorities reported at least 20 people killed in fresh Israeli strikes. Khulud Abu Nada was among the many displaced, with nowhere to go yet again.
It has been 18 days. They have implemented a siege on the north. It was like they put us in a prison. We could not leave.
We cannot take it anymore. We are being exterminated in Gaza, and no one standing beside us.
In Lebanon, Israel's military said it had killed three Hezbollah commanders and some 70 fighters in the south in the past 48 hours. A day after confirming it had killed Hashem Safi al-Din, the militant group's heir apparent leader.
Since October 7th, a year ago,
Blinken, in Tel Aviv before departing for Riyadh, said it was time for Israel to capitalize on its military victories. It's the last major U.S. peace push before the November 5th presidential election, which could upend U.S. policy in the region.
Now is the time to turn those successes into an enduring strategic success. And there are really two things left to do. Get the hostages home and bring the war to an end with an understanding of what will follow.
This was Blinken's first Middle East trip since Israel killed Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, a death Washington hoped could provide an impetus for peace. But Gaza residents say that since Sinwar's death, Israel has only intensified its assault on northern areas.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. A new threat intelligence report from Microsoft says foreign adversaries have shown continued determination to influence the U.S. election, and there are signs that their activity will intensify as Election Day nears. The company said on Wednesday that Russian operatives are doubling down on fake videos to smear Kamala Harris's campaign, while Chinese-linked social media campaigns are targeting candidates who are critical of the Chinese. At least five people are dead and more than a dozen injured in what Turkish authorities are calling a terrorist attack at Turkey's state-run aerospace and defense company near Ankara. Meanwhile, Turkey's defense ministry said its forces struck sites linked to the Kurdish militant group the PKK in Iraq and Syria after blaming them for the attack. Peru's military has been dispatched to various parts of the country to bolster police forces on Wednesday as transport workers went on their third strike in less than a month to protest soaring crime and extortion. Lima was at a standstill as people struggled to get to work with no public transport. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. There is an election soon in Japan. That story's coming up. Now, though, our daily look at the American election takes us to Southern California, where we meet two people selling merchandise for rival campaigns. Genia DeLute has their story.
When California Democrat Sandra Roby saw a booth selling Donald Trump merchandise, she was frustrated by her party's low visibility in the community and decided to open a Kamala Harris booth.
Up until relatively recently, we did not promote our political beliefs out loud. It was something you just kept close to your heart and you lived respectfully amongst each other. But when Trump entered the stage, it all changed. It became kind of like World Federation Wrestling or a sports team, and we could no longer be invisible.
Orange County, California is a solidly Republican enclave in this overwhelmingly Democratic state. Republicans Elvi and Eddie Pantig don't like the Harris booth.
We don't want that.
No, you don't want them together, side by side?
No.
No.
Why not?
Well, you know, Orange County is supposed to be Republican, you know. And side by side is, you know,
and
one, maybe another corner, you know, separate.
In a separate corner, but not together.
California Republican Steve Lawrence runs the Trump merchandise booth. He says there was a bit of tension with Roby at first, but they eventually agreed to share the space.
Just because I'm Republican and she's Democrat, there's no reason that we can't coexist here in the same location. We have different feelings, different opinions about things. Certainly people wear their emotions on their sleeves, but you know, we don't need to have hate that comes into the political views of both parties. We can coexist without having to be so meanful about it.
Democrat Susan Johnson says having the two stalls side by side is a good idea.
I think it's really smart. You know, I think if people just get down and, you know, talk to each other, that they can find a whole lot more in common.
Republican Zaid Habaibi says the stalls show Americans can get along without always agreeing.
This is the freedom that I speak out my mind and I tell what I believe in. I follow the, you know, the democracy regulations in this country. In the meantime, the other party can do as well.
Roby and Lawrence say they have become friends over the last few months and watch out for each other to make sure they're both safe. They say their sign, "We both ask, please be nice," helps lower their customers' political temperatures. Jenny Adulo, VOA News, North Tustin, California.
Meanwhile, thousands of kilometers away from the Southern California sunshine, Japan is preparing to vote too. And a whirlwind month of Japanese politics culminates Sunday with the general election. If polls are accurate, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party could lose seats. It'd be a blow to the party that's ruled Japan for all but four of the past 65 years. And it could also blunt the ambitions of Japan's new prime minister. VOA's Bill Gallo has that story.
Shigeru Ueshiba was all smiles after winning a party vote that made him Japan's new prime minister. But less than a month after forming his cabinet, the honeymoon may already be over. Ueshiba's first major move was to call a general election to solidify his leadership. It may do the exact opposite. Polls suggest the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, will lose ground in the lower house on Sunday, perhaps even its majority, forcing it to share power. Jeffrey Hall is a Tokyo-based political analyst.
This would significantly weaken the LDP. It would very much weaken Prime Minister Ueshiba, and it doesn't look good at all for the party's future.
Ueshiba is facing the fallout of LDP scandals, including one involving unreported political donations. Voters are also frustrated with inflation that has driven up consumer prices. If Ueshiba is weakened, his conservative rivals, which he defeated last month, may pounce, forcing him to the right, says Tokyo professor Michael Kuchik.
If he suffers a major electoral defeat, he'll have to let them back into the central core, and that will actually radicalize Japan, much more likely than moderating its current stance.
Japan's broad foreign policy direction may not change, but an emboldened right could complicate certain aspects, such as warmer ties with South Korea, says Kuchik.
They will not allow Ueshiba, except under very stringent conditions, to be nice to the South Koreans.
Much depends on the election performance of the allies of late conservative icon Shinzo Abe. His faction was involved in the fundraising scandal and may be punished at the polls. Rintaro Nishimura is with Asia Group Japan.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean all of them are getting eliminated. So that means there's still a healthy number of people who can make a scene and, you know, make life hard for the prime minister.
As a result, Ueshiba may need to scale back his foreign policy ambitions and focus on proposals with broader consensus as he navigates more turbulent politics at home. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Journalists in Bangladesh are enjoying much-needed freedom of expression since the ouster of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in August. But as VOA's Sarah Zaman reports from Dhaka, criticizing the opposition that helped oust Hasina can now draw a backlash.
Sayed Khan was arrested in Bangladesh on July 24 while reporting on the deadly crackdown on anti-government protests by the regime of then-Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Khan, a correspondent for a German media outlet, says he was handcuffed, blindfolded, and beaten for hours.
They threatened to take my oldest child, my son, into custody. I was so scared I couldn't speak. They threatened to cut off three of my fingers so that I could not write again.
Khan was released on August 6, the day after Hasina resigned and fled to India. During the last 15 years of her rule, Bangladesh saw a continuous decline in press freedom. Between 2009 to 2024, the country slid down 44 places on Reporters Without Borders' Global Press Freedom Index. Ruksana Anjuman Nicole, a journalist with Jamuna TV, one of Bangladesh's top news channels, says reporters worked within boundaries while Hasina's party, Awami League, was in power.
There were some unwritten rules asking us not to talk about the corrupt practices of certain people. We were well aware of these unwritten rules.
Newsrooms in Bangladesh are adjusting to a new reality where questioning or criticizing the government is not off limits anymore. But given the widespread anger at Hasina and her Awami League, nuanced reporting about them is still a challenge.
Nicole was trolled online after she questioned the actions of protesters who clashed with Awami League supporters on the death anniversary of Bangladesh's founder and Hasina's father, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. Here's Nicole again.
The people want to hear about their deprivation, pain, and anger. They do not want to give any space or relief to the previous government.
On the day Hasina fled, protesters stormed the offices of Shomoy TV and other pro-Awami League outlets. Over 24 journalists seen as supporting the former prime minister are accused of crimes against humanity in connection with the deaths of protesters during Hasina's crackdown on the July uprising. Ahmed Jubair is one of them.
In July and August, the government ordered us to focus on how certain government establishments were vandalized by protesters, and we did that. But accusing journalists of being complicit in murder is truly very unfortunate. I feel this will hinder the freedom of the press in the country.
Faced with threats from state agencies during Hasina's rule, Khan struggled to find a job in domestic media in the past few years. Now he hosts a show on Bangladesh's state broadcaster, exposing the alleged wrongdoings of the Awami League.
My story begins on August 6, when I was released into a free nation from jail. I believe that I am and will be able to report freely now.
Media in Bangladesh may be freer than before, but political divisions run deep. That means journalists still have to watch what they say. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Dhaka.
In a zoo outside Athens, beautiful multicolored butterflies are living their best lives, drinking sweet juice from oranges and living free from the hazards of climate change. Reuters' Alice Rizzo has that story.
In a zoo outside Greece's capital, Athens, thriving butterflies feed on orange slices. That's because this environment is free from the hazards of climate change, currently threatening populations in Greece and across the world. Antonis Ballas works at the Attica Zoological Park.
It severely affects their reproduction and the duration of their lives. So we see that as the climate in their natural environment changes, their lifespan decreases.
Greece is home to some 237 species of butterflies, but warmer temperatures are making their lives harder. Food is becoming scarcer, and flowering periods are getting shorter. Experts also suspect the butterflies may be getting smaller. Agronomist Konstantinos Anagnostelis is part of a research project called Meiosis by the Greek University of Ioannina. Their goal is to model how the body size of butterflies has decreased in response to climate change.
Climate change is impacting butterflies due to rising temperatures, as they are ectothermic and diurnal organisms that rely on temperature to perform essential activities such as mating, reproduction, growth, development, and feeding.
Anagnostelis also says the heat is driving butterflies to cooler areas where there is less food, and that worsening wildfires are further limiting their access to it because of the loss of grasslands. The problem is echoed globally, including Mexico and Britain, where numbers of some species have declined sharply.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us, and that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We'll be right back.